So the speaker this morning is David Miller, and I think most of us know him. He's a retired professor of English from Allegheny College. He's also working on Meadville's climate action plan. Is that correct? So without further introduction, I'll give you David.
Hi, everyone. Such a pleasure to be here, and thank you, Deb, for the invitation to talk today. I love seeing all these familiar faces and look forward to engaging such thoughtful, committed people. The ecology of being, saving the world for democracy. I want to talk today about ecology and democracy in the broadest sense as two interlocking, mutually dependent systems, one predominantly natural, the other largely social, yet neither limited to this distinction. Both, I will suggest, are root metaphors sinking into the deepest reaches of our being and thereby opening out the broadest range to the broadest range of meaning in a tree of life. I should warn you that my interest in democracy goes far beyond the everyday practices of voting and governing, or even politics in general, and maybe that's a reassurance. So what exactly is ecology? Let me quote James Bridle from a marvelous recent book called Ways of Being. Quote, ecology is the study of relationships, those unbreakable cords which tie everything to everything else. Crucially, those relationships extend to things as well as beings. Ecology is just as interested in how the availability of nesting material affects bird populations, or how urban planning shapes the spread of diseases, as it is in how honeybees pollinate marigolds and cleaner wrasses delouse surgeonfish. I've never actually encountered that word wrasses before. Maybe some of you have. That's the end of the quote. So all of this is to say that nature, ecologically speaking, is like evolution, and like democracy, fundamentally leveling of all hierarchies and resolutely self-organizing, its myriad elements evolving much more through cooperation than through competition. Ecology is the principle behind these qualities. It is indeed relentlessly collaborative. As such, I will be arguing it models that what democracy should be. At the very least, we can say that democracy derives from a social vision drawn from nature. Democracy's inherent optimism begins with a fundamental faith in the intrinsic goodness of human beings. It assumes that nurture and growth, not fear and domination, characterize the world we live in. This positive apprehension of life on Earth has given its most eloquent and persistent embodiment in American transcendentalism. But there is much more at stake here, as I hope to show today. And I'm going to get my water because I'm feeling very dry. Since you are a Unitarian Universalist congregation, I want to begin by suggesting the key role played by your spiritual tradition in the emergence of both these touchstones of American life, ecology and democracy, and their reciprocal bearing on how we might communicate most meaningfully, that is to say, effectively, and maybe even lovingly with each other. Excuse me. Today, we live in a world gone crazy over the communication of information and its digital and increasingly phantasmagoric means. Where do we locate reality anymore? I need hardly remind you that the role played by the social media and the growing pervasiveness of depression, especially among young people, the rapid rise of illiteracy among children and adults, the degradation of language wrought by texting and the internet, not to mention advertising and scamming, very much on the rise today, even the notion of learning itself seems to be in jeopardy. In the midst of this world, there is nothing more germane to our well-being and even survival, I believe, than our continuing reliance on oral and written language and concrete vocabulary that it has provided with, us with. You may know that Ralph Waldo Emerson began his professional life as a Unitarian minister. Facing up to the challenges of a market revolution, swiftly transforming America from a land made up largely of yeoman farmers into an industrial capitalist nation, Emerson renounced his religious vocation in the 1830s to become a man of letters and a leading spiritual and intellectual force even today. His stated reason for leaving the ministry was that he could no longer deliver the Lord's Supper in good conscience because he felt he was just going through the motions. The sacrament had been reduced to a lifeless ritual. The bread and wine he bestowed upon communicants no longer meant anything real, experiential, emotional, or spiritual. It was no longer a luminous presence in the souls of those who partook of it. It had been reduced to a dead metaphor. As he embarked on his new calling, delivering addresses and lectures about social and spiritual renewal across the land, Emerson found powerful and affecting ways to present his message of individualism, self-reliance, and attunement with nature. In his shockingly confrontational Divinity School address, he chided the Unitarian establishment of Harvard with an anecdote about listening to his minister drone on. Bored to death, he gazed out the window of his church and was suddenly entranced by the visionary beauty of a snowstorm. That, he declared, was the real sermon. In Nature, his little book of 1836, Emerson audaciously defined the essence of religion as the forging of, quote, an original relationship to the universe by each and every human being. His summons to join a spiritual revolution could not have been more timely. As Americans entered the modern world, as they ran full tilt into the miseries that accompanied industrialization, or were tripped up by the uncertainties of the speculative market in land and other commodities, and perhaps above all, as they were seduced by the meretricious attractions of fashion and other novel aspects of an already voracious consumerism, the conventional aspects of organized religion, such as theology, liturgy, stolid creeds, and what now seem to be mere empty professions of faith, no longer mattered. What would replace all this? Nature, Emerson announced to his audience, would be the new, ever-replenishing source of meaning, gratifying the urges of the soul for kinship, solace, and hope. Constituted authority must gradually give way to journeys inward, relinquishing the rationalism and narrow self-interest driving so many Unitarians at the time. Unitarianism was corpse cold, Emerson declared. In its place, he proposed something alluringly alive, dynamic, and open-ended, an interaction with what was undeniably organic, bringing the sublime resoundingly down to earth and rendering it inspirationally human as well as profoundly personal. Emerson's vision was the seed of an American ecological understanding of nature that has since only gained more meaning and poignancy. Any resemblance of the world we live in today to Emerson's quip that, things are in the saddle and ride mankind is no accident. It is increasingly apparent that unbridled, that is to say, unregulated capitalism and the rampant consumerism it encourages are primary source of almost all our current problems, overshadowing the benefits of the worldwide marketplace, what we now call globalization. Yet we are beginning to wonder whether the entire system of multinational, monopolistic, and alarmingly domineering and immoral corporations is about to unravel, perhaps even ready to implode. Just what are the negative impacts globalization is having on our lives? And in what ways can we begin to counteract them? In the face of such urgent questions, transcendentalism's expansive faith may still be realized, and I think desperately needs to be, although in updated form so that it synchronizes with and eventually reverses the systematic undermining of our lives over the past two centuries, thus enabling us to meet the twin challenges of neoliberalism and climate change. Representing much of what made our nation great, transcendentalism remains an indispensable intellectual, emotional, and psychological resource for the regeneration of society and culture. At its heart is a call to live deliberately and intensively, engaging in experience at first, not at second hand. In rejecting the authority of biblical miracles as secondhand experience for the firsthand miracle of, quote, the falling rain and blowing clover, as he put it, Emerson opened the way for the body, for the entire human organism, holistically imagined, to move into and through nature, and at the same time, to be moved emotionally, thereby transcending the limits of mere thinking of only a notional grasp of the world of secondhand experience, in other words. And I want to point out the tacit but crucial connection here between physical movement and emotional response. Motion, emotion. To be so moved, so motivated, so transfused with emotion, so transfigured with primal energy by engaging intimately with nature betokened an experience of the greatest possible agency as well as immediacy, bringing motor, sensory, and affective capacities into coordination all at once. Accordingly, any aspect of nature could be perceived as transcendent, as mind and body, subject and object, merged into a consciousness of oneness and spiritual immanence in the world. Thus, even the humble ant was sublime, for this creature, while occupying its ecological niche, was ultimately connected to everything else in its environment by a deep-seated sense of purpose and meaning, just as the richly metaphoric potential of ecology would have it. The fulcrum of our self-transformation turns out to be whatever point of view we voluntarily and ingeniously adopt. Such spiritual transcendence gave substance to a faith and practice that was inherently democratic, yet only as long as it was self-generated, only providing it remained untampered by anyone who might set themselves above others, imposing their views and values at will as a step toward domination. Sustaining the freedom and equality of all as not only a basic right, but as the very foundation of our inherently equitable social nature, ensured the creative use and conservation of nature rather than its habitual destruction in the pursuit of financial gain. Ecology, outgrowth of the dynamic matrix of nature, later formulated scientifically in Darwinian evolutionary theory, offered an illustration of the democratic values of equity and interdependence which all organisms luxuriated, all organisms luxuriated. Mouth is drying out. their mutual affinities modeling the social ideal of working together for the good of the whole. Emerson's sense of nature's revelation was nevertheless still limited, not just by his upper middle class sense of propriety, but also by his almost exclusive focus on vision, to the detriment of the other senses and bodily modalities, including sexuality and the motor capacities. It was left to Emerson's disciples, Henry David Thoreau and Walt Whitman, to deepen and diversify the metaphor of nature as the tree of life by incorporating the body as a whole into their response to the environment. This is what I want to stress above all about ecology and what it illuminates. The utter centrality of the organism's ongoing interaction with the environment and, as a consequence, the undeniable importance, along with evolution, of the organism's development, learning, and culture. In providing a more than human dimension to the natural world by encompassing all of life in its self-organization, ecology offers a source of freedom at every level that makes the effort to imagine and remake the world much more of a possibility. It is, that is ecology, in short, the process of becoming extended to infinity. By contrast, it is no accident that genetic determinism, so pervasive today, pairs so well with the restrictive values of capitalism, especially the self-enclosed individualism that is now leading to a growing nihilism and anomie, or at least to a resigned passivity among so many of us, continually undermining the possibility of cooperation through its overvaluing of competition, epitomized by the notion of nature red in tooth and claw. Indeed, we need to recover the true sources of freedom, which lies not in mere self-making or selfish liberty, but in joyful collaboration among inherently social selves. As with ecology itself, it is through our inherently social nature that we coordinate the individual with the good of the whole. And we can remind ourselves of this by just looking at the motto on the Lincoln penny, E pluribus unum, in the many, the one. I don't have time today to say much more about all this, but much of its import is telescoped in the extraordinary ways Thoreau and Whitman interacted with nature through a language gorgeously embodied and dynamic. Thoreau, for instance, recorded in his journal an afternoon spent up to his neck in the comforting slime of a swamp. Experiencing a kind of transport through immersion in matter. Even more to the point, Whitman, in Song of Myself, wrote breathtakingly original poetry from a similar intimate ecological point of view in which body and soul, mind and matter coalesce. Immersed in nature, Whitman becomes profoundly aware of himself as an organism. The smoke of my own breath echoes, ripples, buzzed whispers, love root, silk cred, crotch, and vine. My respiration and inspiration, the beating of my heart, the passing of blood and air through my lungs. Then he moves his attention fluidly from this internal awareness to engage in a vivid exchange, we might say a colloquy, a conversation with the sensory world around him. The sniff of green leaves and dry leaves and of the shore and dark-colored sea rock and of hay in the barn, the sound of the belched words of my voice loosed to the eddies of the wind, a few light kisses, a few embraces, a reaching around of arms, the play of shine and shade on the trees as the supple boughs wag, the delight alone or in the rush of the streets or along the fields and hillsides, the feeling of health, the full noon trill, the song of me rising from bed and meeting the sun. Wow. There is nothing more embodied, nothing so unselfconsciously liberating and endlessly suggestive in all our poetry in English than this passage. The organism soaks in all the energies of the natural setting, the entangled rhythms of body and environment, so enlivening, so excruciatingly resonant and reverberating as to be visionary. This is immanence more than transcendence, down to earth. It is supremely in the world, committed unfailingly to nature, rather than transcending it in pursuit of some disembodied ideal. Thank you.